policy. I will say it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all the strength to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory, however long and hard the road may be. But with...
We gather today at a moment unique in the history of the United States. This is the first time that the United States Congress has solemnly resolved that the President of the United States shall proclaim an honorary citizenship for the citizen of another country. In proclaiming him an honorary citizen, I only propose a formal recognition of the place he has long since won in the history of freedom and in the affections of my and now his fellow countrymen. Whenever and wherever tyranny threatened, he has always championed liberty. Facing firmly towards the future, he has never forgotten the past. Serving six monarchs of his native Great Britain, he has served all men's freedom and dignity. In the dark days and darker nights when England stood alone, and most men, save Englishmen, despaired of England's life, he mobilized the English language and sent it into battle. The incandescent quality of his words illuminated the courage of his countrymen. Indifferent himself to danger, he wept over the sorrows of others. A child of the House of Commons, he became its father. Accustomed to the hardships of battle, he had no distaste for pleasure. Now his stately ship of life, having weathered the severest storms of a troubled century, is anchored in tranquil waters, proof that courage and faith and zest for freedom are truly indestructible. The record of his triumphant passage will inspire free hearts all over the globe. By adding his name to our rolls, we mean to honor him, but his acceptance honors us much more. For no statement or proclamation can enrich its name now. The name Sir Winston Churchill is already legend.
After the end of the World War of 1914, there was a deep conviction and almost universal hope that peace would reign in the world. The phrase, the war to end war, was on every lip, and measures had been taken to turn it into reality. Instead, a gaping void was opened in the national life of the German people, and into that void, after a pause, there strode a maniac of ferocious genius, the repository and expression of the most virulent hatreds that have ever corroded the human breast, Corporal Hitler. In the Second World War, every bond between man and man was to perish. Crimes were committed by the Germans under the Hitlerite domination to which they allowed themselves to be subjected, which find no equal in scale and wickedness. The hideous process of bombarding open cities from the air, once started by the Germans, was repaid 20-fold by the ever-mounting power of the Allies and found its culmination in the use of the atomic bomb, which obliterated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. One day in 1937, I had a meeting with Herr von Ribbentrop, German ambassador to Britain. There was a large map on the wall, and the ambassador several times led me to it to illustrate his projects. After hearing all this, I said at once that I was sure the British government would not agree to give Germany a free hand in Eastern Europe. We were actually standing before the map when I said this. Ribbentrop turned abruptly away. He then said, "In that case, war is inevitable. There is no way out. The Führer is resolved. Nothing will stop him, and nothing will stop us. We then returned to our chairs. I was only a private member of Parliament, but of some prominence. I thought it right to say to the German ambassador, in fact, I remember the words well, when you talk of war, which no doubt would be general war, you must not underrate England. She is a curious country, and few foreigners can understand her mind. Do not judge by the attitude of the present administration. Once a great cause is presented to the people, all kinds of unexpected actions might be taken by this very government and by the British nation. And I repeat it, do not underrate England. She is very clever. If you plunge us all into another great war, she will bring the whole world against you, like last time. At this the ambassador rose in heat and said, ah, England may be very clever, but this time she will not bring the world against Germany. Poland was attacked by Germany at dawn on September the 1st. The mobilization of all our forces was ordered during the morning. I learned later that a British ultimatum had been given to Germany at 9:30 p.m. on September the 1st, and that this had been followed by a second and final ultimatum at 9 o'clock on September the 3rd. The Prime Minister's broadcast informed us that we were already at war, and he had scarcely ceased speaking when a strange, prolonged, wailing noise, afterwards to become familiar, broke upon the air. My wife came into the room, braced by the crisis, and commented favorably upon the German promptitude and precision, and at the quarter of an hour's notice, which we had been led to expect we should receive, was now running out. We made our way to the shelter assigned to us, armed with a bottle of brandy and other appropriate medical comforts.
The fall of the government.
At 11 o'clock, I was summoned to Downing Street by the Prime Minister. There I found Lord Halifax. We took our seats at the table opposite Mr. Chamberlain. He told us that he was satisfied that it was beyond his power to form a national government. The question, therefore, was whom he should advise the King to send for after his own resignation had been accepted. A very long pause ensued. It certainly seemed longer than the 2 minutes which one observes in the commemorations of Armistice Day. Then, at length, Halifax spoke. He said that he felt that his position as a peer out of the House of Commons would make it very difficult for him to discharge the duties of Prime Minister in a war like this. It was clear that the duty would fall upon me, had in fact fallen upon me. Then, for the first time, I spoke. I said I would have no communication with either of the opposition parties until I had the King's commission to form a government. Presently, a message arrived, summoning me to the palace at 6 o'clock. I was taken immediately to the King. His Majesty received me most graciously and bade me sit down. He looked at me searchingly and quizzically for some moments and then said, I suppose you don't know why I have sent for you. Adopting his mood, I replied, Sir, I simply couldn't imagine why. He laughed and said, I want to ask you to form a government. I said I would certainly do so. At last I had the authority to give directions over the whole scene. I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial. My warnings over the last 6 years had been so numerous, so detailed, and were now so terribly vindicated that no one could gainsay me. I could not be reproached either for making the war or with want of preparation for it. I thought I knew a good deal about it all, and I was sure I should not fail. Therefore, although impatient for the morning, I slept soundly and had no need for cheering dreams. Facts are better than dreams. ¶¶ I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. If this is one of the most awe-striking periods in the long history of France and Britain, it is also, beyond doubt, the most sublime. Side by side, unaided except by their kith and kin in the great dominions and by the wide empires which rest beneath their shield, side by side, the British and French peoples have advanced to rescue not only Europe, but mankind from the foulest and most soul-destroying tyranny which has ever darkened and stained the pages of history. Today is Trinity Sunday. Centuries ago, words were written to be a call and a spur to the faithful servants of truth and justice. Arm yourselves and be ye men of valor, and be in readiness for the conflict, for it is better for us to perish in battle than to look upon the outrage of our nation and our altars. As the will of God is in heaven, even so let him do.
Of course, whatever happens at Dunkirk, we shall fight on. Everyone who had a boat of any kind, steam or sail, put out for Dunkirk. Altogether, there came to the rescue of the army, under the ceaseless air bombardment of the enemy, about 850 vessels, of which nearly 700 were British and the rest Allied.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. The Battle of France is over. I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour. The great air battle, which has been in progress over this island for the last few weeks, has recently attained a high intensity. It is too soon to attempt to assign limits either to its scale or to its duration. It is quite plain, sir, that Herr Hitler could not admit defeat in his air attack on Great Britain without sustaining most serious injury. The gratitude of every home in our island, in our empire, and indeed throughout the world, except in the abodes of the guilty, goes out to the British airmen, who, undaunted by odds, unwearied in their constant challenge and mortal danger, are turning the tide of the world war by their prowess and by their devotion. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. All our hearts go out to the fighter pilots, whose brilliant actions we see with our own eyes day after day. I hope, indeed I pray, that we shall not be found unworthy of our victory if after toil and tribulation it is granted to us. For the rest, we have to gain the victory. That is our task. This effort of the Germans to secure daylight mastery of the air over England is, of course, the crux of the whole war. So far, it has failed conspicuously. On the other hand, to try to invade this country without having secured mastery in the air would be a very hazardous undertaking. If this invasion is going to be tried at all, it does not seem that it can be long delayed. Therefore, we must regard the next week or so as a very important week for us in our history. We must take September the 15th as the culminating date of the air battle. On this day, the Luftwaffe, after two heavy attacks on the 14th, made its greatest concentrated effort in a resumed daylight attack on London. It was one of the decisive battles of the war, and like the Battle of Waterloo, it was on a Sunday. I asked whether any results had come to hand. The attack appeared to have been repelled satisfactorily. It was evident that the enemy had everywhere pierced our defenses. Many scores of German bombers with their fighter escort had been reported over London. Although post-war information has shown that the enemy's losses on this day were only 56, September 15 was the crux of the Battle of Britain. On September 17, as we now know, the Führer decided to postpone the invasion indefinitely. Thus perished Operation Sealand, and September 15 may stand as the date of its demise. President Roosevelt has recently made it clear that he would like to discuss with us and with the Dominion of Canada and with Newfoundland the development of American naval and air facilities in Newfoundland and in the West Indies. Undoubtedly, this process means that these two great organizations of the English-speaking democracies, the British Empire and the United States, will have to be somewhat mixed up together in some of their affairs for mutual and general advantage. For my own part, looking out upon the future, I do not view the process with any misgivings. I could not stop it if I wished. No one can stop it. Like the Mississippi, it just keeps rolling along. Let it roll. Let it roll on, full flood, inexorable, irresistible, benignant, to broader lands and better days. We may, I am sure, rate this tremendous year as the most splendid, as it was the most deadly year in our long English and British story. Nothing surpasses 1940. But I and my faithful colleagues had no lack of cares. The shadow of the U-boat blockade already cast its chill upon us. All our plans depended upon the defeat of this menace. The Battle of France was lost.
The Battle of Britain was won. The Battle of the Atlantic had now to be fought.
The other day, President Roosevelt gave his opponent in the late presidential election a letter of introduction to me. And in it he wrote out a verse in his own handwriting from Longfellow, which he said applies to you people as it does to us. Here is the verse. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. What is the answer that I shall give in your name to this great man, the thrice chosen head of a nation of 130 millions? Here is the answer which I will give to President Roosevelt. Put your confidence in us. Give us your faith and your blessing. And under Providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools and we will finish the job.